You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Every year, an estimated 100,000 patients in our healthcare system die as a result of preventable medical errors or infections. But the entrenched culture in medicine has made it difficult to assess and change the risky behaviors that cause these tragedies. In their new book, Beyond the Checklist, Suzanne Gordon, Patrick Mendenhall, and Bonnie Blair O'Connor suggest that the healthcare industry should study the improvements in safety achieved by the aviation industry over the last 40 years and adapt that program. It's published by ILR Press, an imprint of Cornell University Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Suzanne Gordon and Patrick Mendenhall to our show today. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good morning.
So why did you call this book Beyond the Checklist? Isn't there already a medical checklist that doctors are expected to follow?
Well, actually, they're not all expected to follow it, and they're sometimes only expected to follow it in certain places like surgery. But Atul Gawande has written a book called The Checklist Manifesto, which got a lot of attention, and it talks about the kind of aviation checklist as a model. But what we argue is checklists aren't enough. You have to really revamp the culture of healthcare so that people learn how to work on teams and communicate. Because you can have a checklist, and if somebody does it wrong and somebody's afraid to say, you know, you're going to cut off the wrong leg, then you can fill all the checklists you want and they won't work.
Was the aviation checklist developed because of problems in that industry? I imagine it was. When something goes wrong with an airplane, there's a very dramatic result, and hundreds of people can die. We don't hear about the sort of thing you just mentioned, Suzanne, because it's usually one person at a time.
Well, in healthcare, that is a real problem. I mean, there have been estimates that it's, what is it, you know, like a jumbo jet crashing every 2 days. I mean, you know, if 100,000 or more people died in airplane crashes every year and 1.5 million people were injured, nobody would go near an airplane or a car, for that matter. But you're right. I mean, we only hear about the dramatic deaths, you know, but as we're speaking right now, somebody is dying and somebody is being hurt, that it doesn't have to happen.
Patrick, in this book, you cite the work of Peter Pronovost, an intensive care physician at Johns Hopkins. How was he influential in the use of checklists for doctors?
I think he did started a lot of research into how effective a checklist might be. I believe that his first research into that was having to do with the what was that called?
Central venous line catheter infections.
Yeah,
when they stick directly into your heart, kind of.
Yeah, and he theorized that if they just used a checklist, a 5-point checklist, they could reduce infection rates significantly, which they did very quickly, very rapidly, changed the dynamics within just one department.
But then you argue in this book that there's also a downside to promoting his particular story.
Well, one of the big problems in medicine and in healthcare in general, and it used to be the same in aviation, is this what we call the heroic medical narrative. And, you know, you used to have the heroic aviation narrative, the kind of right stuff that Tom Wolfe wrote about. And, you know, it's usually the lone doctor battling against disease and death. Now it's the lone doctor battling for patient safety. I mean, Pronovost actually in his book is better than that. It's just the title of his book, One Doctor's Battle, da-da-da. That's a problem.
Well, doctors are often treated as gods, and so were pilots. But Tom Wolfe said in The Right Stuff that the bad pilots were weeded out by death.
Yeah, right.
Their planes crashed.
Patrick probably has more to say about that than me, having been a fighter pilot and being an airline pilot right now.
Well, there definitely was a process of natural selection, but I think that we've evolved quite a bit from that in recent years, where we're weeded out by our peers and by our superiors in less of a natural set of consequences.
Well, what do these two industries, aviation and healthcare, have in common?
Well, I think that they have a lot in common. I mean, first of all, you have a group of people that used to be it's almost still all men in aviation. Used to be all men in healthcare, docs, physicians, who have a lot of authority and are supposed to be the captain of the ship and the sole decision makers, and they kind of, you know, have the right stuff and they don't listen to anybody else. You have a lot of other people who are supposed to be deferential and not, you know, rock the boat. And then you have us, passengers or patients, who basically our lives are in the hands of these people at the top who, and we hope that they listen to other people, but in the case of aviation now they do, but they didn't, and in physicians they still don't.
Patrick, isn't it the contention of the medical industry that flying a plane is a much simpler occupation with many fewer variables than medicine?
Well,
is that true? You're a pilot.
A lot of people would say that, but I think that it's kind of silly to make to try to make that comparison. I think that both industries have a lot of similarities in their complexity, and I think they can both, or that the medical community can derive a lot of benefit from the cultural shift that occurred in the airline industry.
Well, Suzanne suggested that there's a similar hierarchical system in both. Has that been democratized at all in aviation?
Oh, tremendously. In fact, 30 or 40 years ago, the general mode of operation was the captain was king. He was the god in the cockpit, and you did not dare confront him on an issue, and that caused a lot of accidents. There were a lot of problems where communication just completely shut down between subordinates and the captain. That is a cultural shift that is completely reversed. I think that in aviation, it used to be, you know, in the initial introduction, I'm the captain, I'm king, sit down, shut up, do what I say, and figuratively speaking. And now it's more like, hey, I'm the captain. Yeah, I'm still the king. I still own the ship, but I would appreciate any input that you have. And if I'm making a mistake, let me know.
And I assume those adjustments were important because it's critical for aviation to find a solution. Crashes make headlines, and the perception of that kind of risk would result in fewer people flying. But deaths due to poor medical practice usually don't make the news. We're talking about 100,000 people dying each year because of medical error. And only if the person is really famous does it even make get a newspaper article.
No, that's totally right. And there is, however, an increasing awareness of the human and financial costs of these medical errors and injuries. I mean, obviously, the human costs are that you're either dead or that you're living with, you know, I mean, imagine the worst case, you know, they cut off the wrong leg and now you have no legs.
Does that happen often?
Oh, it happens. I mean, there was
they can't tell the left from the right?
You know what? It's gotten to be, you have people increasingly, I mean, it always happened. It happens everywhere. But I would argue that the conditions are worse now. You have nurses who are working 14 hours, 15 hours a day. You have docs who have no limits on the time that they work. They're tired. They're doing, you know, a sort of assembly line of surgery. They don't really know the patient. And we're human beings, and we make mistakes under the best of circumstances.
Well, how good are hospitals at reporting their errors? Are they obligated to do it?
Well, There are various reporting. Sure, I mean, if you have a huge death or a huge case, you know, then there'll be all kinds of investigations by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, by the Department of Health, et cetera. The problem is that knowledge is not shared in hospitals. A lot of times, in these individual cases that aren't famous cases, you know, some secretary, I mean, like something horrible, knock on wood, happens to you, we're going to find out about it, right? Something happens to somebody's secretary or just a regular person, we're not. And if there's near misses, we're not going to find out about it. And if you sue, you know, then there's a gag order on you, so there's no institutional learning.
And then we can drive to someplace or take a train or a bus. But when we get sick, there aren't any other options, are there?
Well, there should be options, and there's many options, and that's why we wrote the book, you know, because there's many options to traditional training of doctors, nurses, pharmacists, et cetera. There is a new movement for interprofessional education and practice and so forth that people can take advantage of. The question is, are people doing the kind of systematic training that they did in the airline industry? I mean, you and I and Patrick remember all these horrible crashes, you know, Eastern Flight 401 that went into the Everglades, you know, United 173 that crashed in Denver, that horrible flight, you know, the Pan Am KLM in Tenerife. And we don't see those crashes anymore, and we see instead Sullenberger landing on the Hudson, and that's because they've done 30 years of systematic training.
I'm talking with Suzanne Gordon, Patrick Mendenhall, who, along with Bonnie Blair O'Connor, have written a book called Beyond the Checklist about comparisons between the aviation and medical industries. So what happened, Patrick? There were those crashes. Did all the airlines get together and say, we have to change the culture?
Absolutely. In 1979, there was a fairly substantial summit where the FAA and the NTSB, that's the National Transportation Safety Board, industry leaders, managers, trainers, and so on, met and spent a week going over all this whole series of accidents that were occurring. And the conclusion of that meeting was that in the majority of these cases, the pilots, the crews, were at fault. It was not a mechanical problem. It might have been a mechanical problem that started the chain of events that led to the accident, but ultimately the accident could have been avoided were it not for for the actions or inactions of the flight crew. And at that point, they realized that the only way to change this trend was to create a training environment that stressed the cultural deficiencies, stressed the hierarchical nature of how we do business, and actually turn things around.
Well, the hierarchy, I assume, grows out of the history of flight. At the beginning, it was just a pilot. Usually a one-person operation. Sometimes a little later we got co-pilots, but it was pretty much one person who did it all and was responsible for anything that went wrong. Later it got more complicated, and you describe a defining moment on United Flight 173, December 28, 1978. What happened?
Well, that was kind of the end, or the last straw, the tipping point in this series of accidents that were happening. What had preceded that was the development of the black box, the cockpit voice recorder, and the flight data recorder. When those things were invented in the 1970s or came into service in the 1970s, it allowed us to get a view into what was going on in the cockpit. In that particular accident, they realized that that the crew was not working together. The captain had his own agenda or lack of agenda. The first officer and the engineer were both very concerned about the aircraft running out of fuel. They tried to hint and express their concerns to the captain, and he wasn't listening until the airplane actually started to flame out. And after the second engine flamed out, he realized that, oh my gosh, we're running out of fuel. And when the cockpit voice recorder and the flight data recorder were analyzed from that accident, they realized, you know, this is a trend that's happening in a lot of these accidents where people are not communicating, they're not working together, they're not functioning as a team, they're functioning as individuals or professionals that have their own specific set of skills, but they're not working together. And that's when this initiative for crew resource management started.
And what is this, the black box reveal how teamwork was developed on the plane?
Yes, if you think about it, prior to the black boxes, which are interestingly not black, but prior to the invention...
Are they boxes at least?
Well, they are. Yeah, they're computers. They're basically computers that record parameters. The flight data recorder records parameters, flight parameters, the heading, altitude, airspeed, that sort of thing. And the cockpit voice recorder records all the radio conversation and the inter-crew conversations within the cockpit. The significance of this is prior to the black boxes, when an airplane crashed, they'd say, oh, my gosh, well, it crashed because it ran out of gas, or it crashed because the engine blew up or something like that. What they were not able to do prior to the black boxes is they were not able to actually see what was going on in the cockpit. And once they realized what was going on in the cockpit, they realized that a lot of these accidents could be avoided.
Now, there are no black boxes in an operating room, but we'll come back to that and other related matters as we continue this discussion with Patrick Mendenhall, Suzanne Gordon, about a book that they have written with Bonnie Blair O'Connor called Beyond the Checklist. It's published by Cornell University Press imprint called ILR Press. Stay with us for more. We are back with Suzanne Gordon, Patrick Mendenhall, who are two of the three authors of a new book called Beyond the Checklist, the third being Bonnie Blair O'Connor. The book is published by ILR Press, an imprint of Cornell University Press. Suzanne, you tell the amazing story in this book about a 64-year-old woman who went to a major Northeast teaching hospital with a life-threatening bowel obstruction. What happened?
Well, it shouldn't have been life-threatening. It ended up being life-threatening. She had a bowel obstruction. She had surgery to remove the dead bowel. They didn't get enough of it out, and she ended up having serious nutritional problems because she couldn't absorb the food. Her best friend, who was an internist, was with her at sort of every step in this journey, repeated hospitalizations, being sent home on home health care, realized that the problem was not the five cancers that she had had a while ago, which the oncologist said, you know, in a note in the chart, should not be impacting her chances of survival or anything. And she kept saying, you know, she's not absorbing food, she's not eating. And the docs got this picture of her as, because she had these five cancers, she's just kind of like that. And my friend and her friend, the internist, kept trying to intervene, and they would blow her off. And so here's a physician trying to talk to other physicians and being told, who do you think you are? Finally, somebody listened to her, and 3 months later, they realized that she was essentially starving to death. But the whole point is, you have to welcome other voices into your diagnosis, your treatment plan.
Including the person, the patient, him or herself.
Absolutely. I mean, in this case, the woman was getting to be so nutritionally compromised that she couldn't, you know, function and couldn't say this is what's going on.
Well, there are other kinds of checklists. When a doctor suspects that you have a certain kind of illness, he or she will go down a list of different things.
Diagnosis.
And if you don't have, let's say there are 10 things, and if you don't have more than five of them, they will discount it often, even if that is the problem.
Right.
And I've spoken to a number of people who've been sent home being told that it's all in their heads when they actually had a problem, but they just didn't follow all of the obvious signs in the diagnosis that the doctors were looking for.
Well, I think that, you know, I mean, the subtitle of our book is What Else Healthcare Can Learn from Aviation Safety and Teamwork. And, you know, there's so much wrong with the healthcare system. We could spend the next 100 years, you know, talking about everything that's broken. But I think when it comes to patient safety, it really is this issue of how do you talk to each other? How do you learn? I mean, you walk into a hospital, you see the typical scene. Doctor walks into patient's room, passes nurse going out. There's no conversation between them. There's no updating. There's no briefing. There's no debriefing. I mean, you can do a surgical checklist, but if that patient can get into trouble on the wards, and if you're not talking to the nurse and the pharmacist and so forth, you know, and the nurse doesn't feel comfortable saying, I'm really uncomfortable with this, I've noticed this, and if you don't say thank you, then it's a real problem.
Well, hasn't the increased technology been cutting down on some of that? Because we're talking about incompetence, and I thought that, in many cases, technology was going to cut down on incompetence.
Well, the problem isn't incompetence. The problem is, it's not technical incompetence. It's communication and teamwork incompetence because they're not taught how to talk to each other. Their doctors are taught sometimes how to talk. They're taught patient communication. Nurses are taught patient communication. They're never taught team communication. They're not taught conflict resolution. I mean, you're a nurse, and you have a problem with a med I'm giving. You know, you either say it or you don't say it, or sometimes, you know, are you trying to kill the patient or the doctor blows you off? Leonard, when you get when you have your MD come and talk to me, then I'll listen to you. That kind of stuff goes on all the time. And people don't know how to raise issues. It's a skill raise issues.
Shouldn't medical schools be teaching doctors to be more open?
Well, actually, they are trying to teach doctors to be more open to patients, which isn't entirely succeeding, but they're working on it. But I think that the issue has to be skill building in getting doctors to work with the team, because if the doc won't listen to the nurse and he won't listen to the pharmacist and he won't listen to anybody else, he ain't going to listen to the patient.
Patrick, how did United Airlines develop their Command Leadership Resource Management Program?
Well, I think all the airlines jumped in shortly after United, but yeah, United was the leader in that.
Did they begin with the pilots?
They did. They began just with the cockpit. In fact, they called it cockpit resource management, but very quickly after that, they realized that whatever was good, the improvements in communication within the cockpit would also apply to the rest of the crew, and so they changed the term to crew resource management, and then that concept actually expanded to all members of the team, which included the ground crew, included the agents and the baggage handlers and everyone else, and the idea being that everyone is inclusive in this team operation. For instance, if a baggage handler who is kind of considered, you know, at the lower end of the chain of the hierarchy, if he sees a bolt on the ground next to a tire, he's definitely empowered and encouraged to go and find somebody and say, hey, you know, I just saw this thing. Maybe you ought to take a look at it. And so that's how the concept has expanded to include everyone.
Was everybody open to it? The pilots were given 25 hours of homework before they arrived. Did they all do it?
They eventually did because it was mandated that they did, and that was that in the case of CRM, that was one of the big secrets to success, is that we didn't really have a choice. And every pilot, myself included, was resistant to that. In fact, we didn't really want to be part of a training that involved other groups or whatever. We didn't feel that it was appropriate. But once we were forced into that environment where we were working, for instance, with the pilots, working with the flight attendants in kind of a team exercise as part of our training, we very quickly realized, oh my gosh, there is something here that we need to work with these people.
What about hiring people who would be more open to that sort of thing?
The airlines have, I believe, made a great effort to target individuals that are team players. They've developed psychological profiles so that they can weed out people very, very quickly or very early in the process that would be resistant to working with other people.
My guests are Patrick Mendenhall and Suzanne Gordon, who, along with Bonnie Blair O'Connor, have written a book called Beyond the Checklist, What Else Healthcare Can Learn from Aviation Teamwork and Safety. It has a foreword by Captain Chesley Sully Sullenberger, and it is published by an imprint of Cornell University Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Did they all speak the same language? Was that part of this process, getting everybody to use the same terms?
Very much so. In fact, I mean, I'll give you just a very... The very basic thing is if a flight attendant were to call up, okay, first of all, we know we need to listen. If a flight attendant calls an intercom and says, hey, we see a problem, whereas in the past we may not. We might be more inclined to blow her off 40 years ago, her or him. But the flight attendant knows, as far as the common language is concerned, knows to say there is smoke coming out of the engine next to door one left. And we all know that means aircraft left, because the flight attendant may be facing the back of the airplane, but he or she knows that they need to refer to aircraft left or aircraft right, not what they're seeing on the right hand or the left hand. That's just a very small example, but we all are trained in how to achieve that common language.
Well, what about in a hospital? Isn't it true in terms of healthcare that physicians and nurses don't even use the same vocabulary when they're talking about patients?
It's really incredible. I mean, because historically nurses were not allowed to use medical language, some medical language.
Because they weren't allowed? Why?
Well,
because they were seen as a threat to the doctors?
No, because you were supposed to describe the symptoms. So if you said the patient has a UTI, a urinary tract infection, the patient is having a myocardial infarction, i.e. a heart attack, whatever, that's making a diagnosis. It's not making a description. So you're supposed to say the patient is having burning and frequency and, you know, da-da-da-da-da. And so what ends up happening is that, because historically, you know, the nurse was supposed to know what to do and how to do it, but not why she was doing it. So you have this thing called nursing diagnosis where they actually speak different languages. Nobody really knows the history of that. And so what the docs think is like, well, why don't these people get to the point? What they don't understand is that getting to the point would mean, you know, encroaching. I mean, people have to use the same language if they're going to be able to quickly work on teams together.
Don't healthcare professionals say that predictable communications are impossible because of the constant uncertainty?
Well, that's why you have to have predictable communication. You, first of all, you know, it's kind of like who said it? I can't remember, you know, 24 hours of boring routine and, you know, 10 minutes of hysterical action or something. I mean, not everything is a crisis. And what you do is you have to practice predictable patterns of communication, so when things are in crisis, you don't go nuts. And the other thing you have to do is, the other thing they say, Leonard, is they say, oh, well, we can't practice this stuff. We can't do this stuff because there's an ever-changing cast of characters. In aviation, there's an ever-changing cast of characters, too.
But you're also being trained in a threat-free atmosphere, and then suddenly you have to deal with something where there's a major crisis and there's a lot of stress. Can you be prepared for that?
Sure, you can learn. I mean, that's what Sully Sullenberger had to do when he had 303 minutes and 28 seconds to land that plane on the Hudson. If you learn, there's lots of opportunities to rehearse and to practice that aren't being taken advantage of in healthcare.
Patrick, what are crew briefings and when do they take place?
They take place throughout the flight. Of course, the most common, or the one that everyone understands or relates to, is the initial crew briefing. Suzanne mentioned that the cast of characters is always changing, and that is absolutely true in aviation. In fact, now the way, because of computer scheduling and so on, oftentimes I'll fly a trip for 6 or 8 or 10 days where I'll never have the same crew members with me at any leg. I'll never duplicate that crew. In other words, I'm the every flight is a different crew. And the way we get around that, or the way that we deal with that, is that, well, number one, the common language. We speak a common language, but we do crew briefings at the beginning of every flight. And that's, as I mentioned, that's sort of what everyone's familiar with, is the briefing before the flight. We brief the pilots will do flight planning, and then the captain or the entire flight deck crew will go in and brief the flight attendants on things like what they can expect as far as weather, any particular security situation, or any anomalies that we can expect during the flight, or any special situations.
And people don't tune out the way they do, the passengers do, when the video comes on and tells us how to fasten our seat belts and how to use our seat as a flotation device?
Absolutely not, because for one thing, it is an ever-changing situation. It's never the same. Every flight is different, and so people want to, they long for that information. For instance, when we do a flight attendant briefing, they want to know. They want to know what we have to share, what we have to impart. It's a very effective tool and quite necessary. And then, of course, as far as briefings go, we communicate via briefings throughout the flight, you know, prior to just as we take the runway. There's about a three-step briefing that the pilot flying will give to the other crew members, just so that, like, here's a reminder, here's what we're about to do, and here's the biggest threat that lies before us, so beware of that. And as we, before we descend, before we do an approach briefing and a descent briefing and so on. And so it's part of every aspect of the flight.
Are we seeing similar things in hospitals, Suzanne?
Oh, no. Unfortunately, we are not. I mean, as I pointed out before, you know, I was recently talking to a surgeon, a female surgeon, who said, well, of course I go in and I tell my team, quote unquote team, you know, what I think is important, never asking them what they think is important. And then when she was told by some patient safety doctors who were addressing the group I was watching that, you know, she should do debriefs and stuff like that, her attitude was, well, if things went well for me, I mean they must have gone well for everybody. Why do I have to take my time to do a debrief?
So what kinds of objections have the healthcare industry brought up about the feasibility of applying the kinds of practices that we see in the aviation system to healthcare?
Well, they are legion. I mean, you know, one of them is that aviation has nothing to do with healthcare, to which we respond, wait a minute.
Well, I have a fear of flying, and I have a fear of being operated on.
Yes, yeah, so clearly you know that there are similarities, right? And you're right to have a fear of both, but I think that it's safer to fly than to go into a hospital.
Well, didn't the government step in to help the aviation department develop the CRM model? Can it do the same thing in healthcare?
Well, yes.
Since it pays for so much of our healthcare?
Absolutely. I mean, the Federal Aviation Administration made crew resource management team trainings a requirement in 1991. Patrick can tell you about what he has to do. You know, every year or twice a year, he has to go to these trainings. People watch how he flies an airplane. You know, they make sure that his teamwork skills are great. This is not true in healthcare, and we don't, unfortunately, have a Federal Aviation Administration. However, there are groups that are very interested in making things safer, and we have a training that was developed by the federal government called Team Steps. It's a free training. A lot of hospitals are doing it. The problem is they're not necessarily doing it the right way. You have to have recurrent training. I mean, these pilots and flight attendants and ground crews go through training every year in their career. You can't change behavior, as you know, with your toddler by saying, please, and, you know, sweetie, you have to say please and thank you, and then you sort of, that's it. That was the only time. You change culture by constantly revisiting things.
We have to end it there, unfortunately. But my great thanks to Suzanne Gordon, who has written a number of books about medical issues. Patrick Mendenhall, who is a commercial pilot and a member of the Airline Pilots Association, for being on our show. They have written with Bonnie Blair O'Connor, who is Associate Director of Pediatric Residency at Hasbro Children's Hospital, Alpert Medical School in Brown University. They have all collaborated on a book called Beyond the Checklist, What Else Healthcare Can Learn from Aviation Teamwork and Safety. It is published by the Cornell University Press. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.